Welcome to the podcast dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee, and we have with us today Kyle Pfaffenbach from Eastern Oregon University, also from the Brooks Beast. We're stoked to have you back, Kyle.
Appreciate it. Happy to be here. This is cool.
We also have our CEO, Nate Pearson. It's going to be good times. Nate, we're going to talk about carbs today.
Yes. I was hoping we would.
Nate wants to talk about carbs.
That's right. Before we do that, if you're listening to this now and you have not yet tried Red Light, Green Light, that's a new feature that we've released that athletes, Nate, AI FTP detection was wildly popular because people didn't have to do painful FTP tests. I think the, like, you know, on the like ratio on this one is even higher. Like people are, this is hugely popular.
Yeah. And instead of like once a month using it, you can use it every day. So that's the benefit. Yeah. You can mess up your training every single day and it can tell you opportunities.
Yeah. This allows you to be able to do those group rides or do the other things that you want and say yes to them, but still keep your training on track. It's amazing. Go check it out. If you don't like it, you can get the emoji thumbs
up.
Thank you, Apple, for turning that on. They YouTube'd us by putting U2 on all of our phones, and now they turned on this emoji thing so that we get emojis on all of our videos. Yeah, exactly. But if you haven't yet tried it out, go check it out, trainerroad.com, and look back at your training history. It's really cool because you can see like, yes, that's accurate. And then that'll give you confidence for the future. And if you don't like it, we'll give you your money back. We're pretty confident you like it. So go try it. Okay. But now let's get into Laura's question. She submitted this at trainerroad.com/podcast. You can do that there, or you can do it through Spotify as well. And if you're listening on any platform, YouTube, whatever it might be, give this a like, thumbs up, share, all that great stuff. Laura says, do you know of studies that show how long it takes to adapt to high carb intake rates on the bike? Thanks to the podcast, I upped my carb intake from, well, basically nothing up to 80 grams per hour. And like you said, it felt like I was cheating. I had the best year of training I've ever had, which is saying something as a 41-year-old woman who has been cycling since my mid-20s. Fast forward to today starting my base training, having not eaten a gel since October, and I'm having a really hard time taking in even 40 grams per hour. It has me freaked out thinking I've lost the ability to take in carbs, but I know you've mentioned it does take time. But impatient me wants to know how long and why. Thanks for your help. This one's huge because I think finally we talked about this maybe last time. It seems like the world is starting to become more aware that like endurance athletes take in a lot of carbs, and endurance athletes themselves, even the best ones in the world, are actually starting to do it. So there is suddenly like this dragging up of everybody thinking like, oh, I do need to take in more. So this is probably super relevant for a lot of people. Kyle, have you observed this? And like, we can get into like the mechanisms in terms of what's going on, but, and I don't know if you know of any research that's actually like established on this, that it takes this long to adapt to this. I'm sure it's individual.
So that was going to be my main point, the one that you just made. I mean, there's a lot of cool stuff that we can talk about around this, but at the end of it, like, it's just going to be different for everybody. And the top end of what people can achieve and be comfortable with in terms of the massive amounts that they can get in is also going to be variable. And it just sort of depends. It depends on how sensitive your gut is. It depends on how healthy your gut is. It depends on just probably a bunch of genetic factors that we haven't like even established yet. I'm sure I'm leaving some things on the table, just in terms of like my knowledge and gaps in it. But I think the key is, I mean, there's a lot of cool stuff to talk about around this, but if I only had like 3 seconds to answer Laura's question, it would be, just give it time and keep trying and go slower than faster. Like, don't say, oh, I was here at the end of last year, I should maintain those. So if you don't maintain stimulating a system, we typically lose the ability of that system, or we revert back down to like what our genetic baseline is. And so if she took a really, and there's a little bit of one of the things that I've seen before, and this is purely anecdotal. One of the things that I've seen before is there's sort of a compressed timeline around the length of time it took to have an adaptation once you've experienced and enjoyed that adaptation for some point in time. So the thing with Laura is like, she had never experienced higher carbohydrates, and she probably took like a very conservative approach, whether she knew, like, either she was still a little dubious of it, or I've been cycling since I was 20. What are these guys talking about? And then you finally, like, there's probably some experimentation that she's not counting or not remembering. I'm not putting, Laura, you may have the most amazing memory of anybody. I'm just generally saying, I'm not going after her cerebral cortex. So I'm just saying that a lot of times we think about, we, it's sort of like a relationship that's in the rearview mirror. You remember the good times. And so you sort of have compressed that to a point where it probably took you quite a bit of time to get used to 80 grams of carbs. And you may not have even hit that until like a key race or something where you're like, I know this is going to help me. The evidence is there. I'm trending in the right direction. I'm just going to go for it. And then that happened. And then you think like, okay, well, and to be fair, Laura was talking about her base training. I'm pretty sure she submitted that question like December or January, but we're on a one, we're on a one question per podcast pace right now. And so, yeah, to be fair, I don't think she's just started her base training right now. And it'd be interesting to hear from her, quite frankly, and see if that adaptation did occur. But I'd be really hesitant to give anyone a particular timeline. What I would say, however, I'm just trying to think of this. If I was like her nutrition consultant, for example, and I was thinking about this, I think if there was no progress or there was, issues. So she was having a lot of GI issues. There were things that weren't just like, oh, I feel like I'm sort of stressing the system a little bit and expanding my ability to do this. If there were like clear things with GI distress and stuff like that, at that point, I wouldn't just say, oh, just give it time. Like we'd have to figure out what was going on at that point. And there's a bunch of cool things that can affect carbohydrate absorption. And yeah, we could talk about those. But I'd say generally, yeah, you just have to give it time and you have to kind of up it. And then you also have to, it's sort of like hydration in the sense that it's not the same under all conditions. And so it's going to be easier for you to train your gut on easy recovery rides. But that's a lot of times when people aren't thinking about eating as many carbohydrates as they possibly can because they're easier like zone one or zone two rides. And so you do have to be sort of intentional about, okay, yes, I'm doing this zone one or zone two ride. Yes, I could use fat as a fuel and run a pretty low like RER on this and make it through and be fine. But I'm actually intentionally trying to train my gut and I want to do it under conditions where I'm not as stressed. And so I'm going to try and push it a little bit here, almost like as a, you can be intentional about it. I don't know if that makes sense.
Kyle, you've been, I've said this years ago and people got so mad at me for it.
Yeah, exactly.
So can you imagine though, like in the 90s, yeah. I guess 90s is a bad time because of all the doping, but when there was hopefully less doping, but then you're the only one who actually had tons of carbs and everyone else didn't. Like the
everyone would think that you were doping. Yeah,
exactly. That's what Lance just.
Lance just did a ton of carbs.
Exactly. 160 an hour. That was it. Kyle, what about, she talks about gels. Personally, I can get to like 140 on liquid. Gels destroy me. How does that impact people, or what things should people try?
I think it's like, it's honestly personal preference. Like it's, and culturally it's different between sports that I found. So like, for example, runners just think like elite runners, usually when I initially talk to them, and again, I'm painting with broad brush strokes here. But they're just like, oh, those are gels are for like old people that are trying to like break 4 hours in the marathon. Like that's who eats gels, right? or like, you know, obviously there's been a revolution in elite marathoners. Like, those studies go way back. They go back into the late 80s, early 90s, where people were demonstrating that if you can get this fuel source in that has a limited capacity, that we have a limited capacity to store in the form of glycogen, if you can get that in at proper rates, you can sustain higher outputs for longer. I mean, this is like, this isn't new, even though the application of it does feel kind of new, or it's like feels reborn in some ways. So in terms of runners, for example, they have a hard time dealing with liquid because it's just, it's heavy, it's sloshing, it's cumbersome to carry. Not ultra runners. I'm talking about people, though, that are doing like, I want these track and field athletes that are doing 12 to 15 miles at 5:30 pace on Sunday to like fuel, and they just aren't. And so there we've just come up with things where like, it's like, and we negotiate like, you can have this much gel. You can, okay, I'll carry three, but I'm not carrying five. It's like this type of stuff, right? Or I have this much capacity. So that part of it, just the logistics of it, like, so even if they don't like gel, we have to find a gel that works for them because they're not going to run with water, for example. Cyclists are a little bit different. Like there's just, you have to experiment in your own. And when I say experiment, I don't mean to be like, you have to hold on so tight that you have to lay out everything that you're going to do before every ride and go from there. What I'm saying with experiment is that when you try something new, or when you try something convenient, or when you find a product that you seem to like the taste of, or you can stand the taste of, you need to have awareness around that. So it's just, I like that under these circumstances. When it's hot, I found this one easier to take on. When it's really hard ride, when I'm doing a 6-hour ride, I find that this flavor starts to like really seem too sweet and nasty, and I need something with a little less flavor or a little less sweetness. So again, these are so like broad, these are such broad answers, but there's no one sort of just right thing to say, oh yeah, you're a gel, this is why. Oh, you prefer liquid, this is why. It's that was a really long non-answer. Oh, I was also going to throw in there that soccer players are the worst. They're basically doing high intensity intermittent aerobic and anaerobic exercise for 90 minutes, and they only maybe take a couple squirts of water during an entire game, and they barely eat. Every soccer player that I've ever talked to, when I'm like, hey, you should put some gels under your compression shorts, and when there's like a stoppage of play or plays on the other side of the field, you should eat them. And they're just like, it's just like so anathema to that culture. And but I think it would be like a huge competitive advantage for people, especially later in games. And there's actual studies demonstrate. Anyways, we don't want
to. Yeah. I think at soccer, sorry, I'm going to entertain your tangent for a bit because I love soccer, but I think it's like roughly seven miles that the average player runs during a match. And
yeah, between 10 and 12K.
That's effectively like sprinting. Bursts of sprinting. It's like just sugar burning. Like that's like what they're doing. 100%. It's
and like the thing is that like we see such a drop off in when you look at the GPS data, you start to see that like people use really interesting pacing strategies because they know they only have so much glycogen. And they're not replacing it, so they can't just go all out all the time. The other thing that happens is that they sort of pick their spots more selectively as the game goes on, and their sprints are slightly slower and much shorter in length. So, like, if there's a situation that they could attend to somewhere, but it's too far away, it wouldn't have been too far away when they were full of glycogen. And there's central nervous implication. Like there's a bunch of cool, there's central fatigue, like implications and stuff like that. But so culturally it's like, it really matters. Cyclists I think are the best, like cyclists and triathletes are pretty good too. Yeah. And they like embrace it. They know it, but these are also people that have a lot of access, to like very clear performance numbers. They can see what it does. They're also the volume is really high. I think the worst, the hardest sport to like feed somebody on is swimming, because like it's not easy to eat, but the volume the nature of the sport requires massive training volumes. And so that's some unique challenges. So like, yeah, I mean, if I was talking to you, Nate, and you were like, I don't really like gels, I like drinking fluid, I'd just say then drink fluid, especially if you can just, if you can get it in. And there'd probably be some times where like, if you were so sick of it, we would mix in like some solid foods. And there's some pretty good bars out there now that are, you know, low in fiber and don't have a lot of fat and stuff like that. And it would just depend on the situation.
Mm. I was thinking like that curiosity.
Go ahead.
Sorry, Nate. Go ahead.
I was just thinking if you got stuck on one gel at a certain, like at 40, maybe then try to do gel and drink or just drink and mix it up if you get stuck. Even if you love the gel, this is the best tasting gel I've ever had.
100%. Yeah. Okay. So I don't know. So like I said, the runners go with just the gels. The cyclists, we almost always try and run a combination. And it's very tailored to what they kind of just their personal need, right? They have different tolerances to sweetness. They have different tolerances to just the texture. They have different tolerances to there's literally like the enjoyment factor, I think, is pretty important when you're spending so much time and you're just eating. There's also a cost at a certain extent. Like a lot of the people I work with have sponsorships, right? And so that's fine. But if you're like trying to buy whatever, if you're going through like three or four Never Second gels an hour and you're riding 20 hours a week, that's like a lot of money to just spend in. You can figure out how to make your own kind of gels and drinks and those types of things. There's also, you know, it's interesting with the gravel folks, there's a big gas station culture now in terms of just like, it's all about calories and just what can we grab. And there's real conversations that happen with the gravel riders around, like there's some things that probably aren't going to help your performance if you choose foods with those ingredients, even if those foods seem to be high in calories and they're enjoyable. Other times you say, yeah, okay, well then let's just get those things and make an exception because you're on an 8-hour ride and you have to have some sanity. So, I mean, it's just hard to give like a single sort of thing. What I will say in regards to this, Nate, is that the hotter it is, the harder it is to take on solids or gels. And the harder you're exercising, the harder it is to take on solids and gels. So there's an inverse relationship between like heat stress and intensity stress and the complexity of the carbohydrate that you're the complexity of the form of the carbohydrate you're trying to take on.
What about I've seen the drinks talk about osmolarity, and can you explain what that is and like why we care about it? And it always seems silly because you're eating food, but then also drinking this perfect osmolarity drink. Yeah. And I'm like, but I'm having gel at the same time. Does that mess it up? Like,
yeah.
I don't get it.
Yeah. Yeah. So shout out to this guy named Oscar Ukendrup. He's like a legend. You guys may have heard of him or come across his papers or that sort of thing. So he's really like his academic route. He was an academic based over in England, I think, is where his big. And now he kind of does stuff for different companies and different world tour teams and things like that. But he really has some really important papers going back into the 90s and early 2000s regarding this idea that it's the way the gut functions and the way the gut works, it's more than just putting the nutrient into the gut. Like that isn't the only thing that's happening there. And there's a balance between the salt, the water, and the carbohydrate, and there's co-transporters that matter. And so the other thing is that with the osmolarity, you're basically there talking about, you're basically talking about different concentration gradients and how things can move across those with selective barriers or selective receptors and things like that that are involved. So the basic way that I explain this is I just say that like there's different receptors doing different things in your gut that are facilitating the uptake of different types of sugars and different types of fluids and different types of nutrients into the systemic system. And so if you really back up and think about this, like our digestive tract is literally this tube that is through the middle of our body that is goes from the opening on the top and in the front to the opening at the bottom and in the back. And that tube is kind of separate from the rest of our body, what we call the systemic circulation or the systemic system. And the idea is that we don't process the ability to make everything that we need to function as a human life form. We have to consume things. And so when we consume things, your timing was impeccable there. when we consume things, it goes down this tube system. I'm obviously like simplifying this, but it goes down the tube system. And then we reserve the ability to extract the things that are going to help the system and leave the things that aren't going to help the system or help the system in a way that helps the gut itself function. And so, for example, this is the actual definition of an endotoxin. You know, people say like, oh, drink lots of water, it'll flush the toxins. And I'm like, could you define that, please? Could you like tell me how it's measured? Could you give me like
this is another thing that Nate pointed out on the podcast years ago, by the way. I'm catching some a lot of flack for
do you just bring me on? Like people are gonna start to think we pre-pod and I'm just yeah, and you're like things. Listen, you gotta say this. I've been hanging it's on actually, to this for 3 years, you gotta
I'm just a fan of science, Kyle, and so to have a scientist on that can explain all this stuff is validating.
Oh yeah,
the people scientist. Argue with me though so bad, like the toxin thing. That's
the scientist like, who describes like, it. I just described the digestive system as a tube. It's a whole up and hold the bottom. Yeah,
very scientific.
Yeah, it's so scientific. Very eloquent. So anyways, the idea here is that So we don't want endotoxins, for example. And when endotoxins do find their way into the system, we typically have a bad reaction to that. So this is what like stomach flus and stomach bugs and things like that are. And you try and eject everything that's in the tube as efficiently as possible. And you run up a fever to try and kill the bacteria that's made its way into the system. But we're eating bacteria all the time. We're eating stuff that we don't want into the system all the time. But the integrity of the gut is maintaining the sort of, it's selecting and taking out what's. So the idea of osmolality is the relationship between particulates in a certain amount of fluid. And the balance between particulates and fluid across membranes can influence the way things move across those membranes. That's the most simple way to put it. And so what we know is that different variations in osmolality influence the way things move across that membrane and the efficiency with which they do so. There's also some like transporters that work with multiple components, not just like, so there isn't just like a hole, for example, that kind of, So transportation of molecules across membranes can be more complex than just a pore that's in the shape of the thing that it's letting across. And so, for example, there are kind of transporters that bind sodium along with glucose and transport those across the membrane with water, for example. So like, for example, from an electrolyte standpoint, Gatorade always talks about, I'm just using them because everybody knows who they are. And there's actually a lot of really interesting R&D that has been done. Gatorade has a GSSI. They have a Gatorade Sports Science Institute. Before they were bought by Pepsi, it was a very interesting kind of, there's a lot of cool stuff going on there. And so with that in mind, Gatorade sort of puts salt in their solution. And they talk about replacing electrolytes with sweat and stuff like that. But the amount, if you look closely, the amount of electrolytes that are in Gatorade are way below what are recommended or what are found in other more electrolyte specific drinks, especially for people that are salty sweaters, which is a different topic. And but what they found was that they could increase the ability to get sugar into the gut if they put it with a certain amount of liquid and a certain amount of salt. And that's kind of my understanding is that's the idea behind that. And so you have these co-transporters, you have these different ways of getting different things across the barrier. There also is some evidence, and you guys are also aware of this because you know there's a lot of attention on the like mixtures and the sort of ratios of fructose to glucose and how much this and that. And one of the things that's kind of interesting is that you know, glucose and fructose are handled differently by the liver as well. So that's kind of interesting. But they're also like there seems to be a multiple ways to get things across the gut. Well, there are multiple ways to get things across the gut barrier into the systemic circulation. And if you have only one kind of molecule, it seems to slow that down. And so you put a mixture of molecules into there. And I could be like, I don't spend a ton of time researching this because it's in like really boring down into every paper. So I'm sure we can find someone that could like speak more eloquently than this on it. But from a practicality standpoint, you want a mixture of sugars. You don't want high fructose corn syrup. You don't want too much fructose. You want a mixture of a variety of chains of chain lengths of glucose seem to help. So you can have some amylopectin, for example, some longer chains. You can have some simple glucose. You have a little bit of fructose and like all of that with some salt and water in not too concentrated of a form seems to play really nice with the stomach.
Yeah, this is, and that's why I feel like athletes probably don't have to worry about maintaining this perfect osmolarity of their gut, right? To be able to say that like, yes, everything, you know, because I took in that gel and I didn't take in a certain amount of water or vice versa, I've thrown it all off and I'm not going to be able to digest. Rather, that actually a certain, like a diverse profile within our gut, within certain constraints does seem like it's that's the main thing that you want to have.
Yeah, that's, so I think you bring up a really good point, but there's a couple, so the gut is sort of like the kidneys where they're like exact, but they sort of do their own thing. Like you just give it what they need and they'll make the adjustments. It'll make the adjustments that it needs to the degree that it's able to make that adjustment. So when we have conversations about hydration, for example, it's in the same vein where it's like, it's exactly inexact. I don't know if I'm describing this like properly or right, or, but the point is that like, you can get the right mixture of things generally. And as long as you're pretty close, these things will take care of themselves. But there are going to be little pieces of individuality within there. So you may know I get a really sensitive gut when it's hot out, or I get a really sensitive gut when I do threshold workouts. And so I need to find something that doesn't, that works where I can absorb nutrients that plays nice with my stomach. But there isn't just like one formula. That's where that idea of awareness comes from, where like, you're like, okay, I'm going to offer variability. I'm going to understand these things about my gut under these different conditions. I take care of my gut with other things that make it receptive to taking these things on. And then I'm going to figure out like what it is that works under different circumstances. And to be honest with you, like having a good gut that can take just a lot of sugar in and actually absorb it without a lot of GI distress, and having a high tolerance for sweetness is like a talent for an endurance athlete. It's 100% a talent.
Kyle, when I was in college, I wanted to run a marathon. This is when I first was reading about carb intake and calories and stuff like that. And my training, I was like, okay, I want to be able to eat a lot and be able to still work out. So I would eat a full dinner in college as much as I can. And I would sprint this like 3 mile track as fast as I could with a completely full stomach. And I thought, I'm going to train myself to be able to handle a bunch of food in my stomach and running. And I mean, that was 20 years ago. I think it paid off. Like, yeah. it worked. I can use
like when
now,
people but... when people have iron guts, it's like, now not everybody would have been able to adapt to that, so that's like a genetic gift.
They didn't try hard enough.
Yeah, exactly. What's the definition of insanity? So I think though that this is awesome. We're just rehashing the.
In like 10 years, someone's going to be like, "What you need to do is do sprints, when you're the full stomach, and they show that your body adapts and." But the amount of food in your stomach changes. It's like an inexact science.
So, I mean, when we this is awesome. When we bring it back to Laura's question, and what I would say to her is like, one, if you have a record of an actual objective record, not recollection record of what the process was like the last time she got carb adapted and got up to 80 grams of carbs per hour. To kind of look at that timeline and maybe recreate it possibly slightly more aggressively. Two, did she switch the products that she was using when she was at the 80 grams and that she's trying now? Maybe she heard something from somebody, or she's going to try this new thing, or she's making her own, or those types of things. So assess what it is that you're doing. Three, look at like, are there particular intensities and are there particular environmental conditions that are causing it? Because if she's saying like, oh, I have these big workouts and eating so many carbs was so good for me, I'm only going to do it during the hard workouts. Well, then you're going to have a harder time training the gut up to be able to have the capacity to do that. And then four, like, You really have to make sure you're well hydrated. And then there's a bunch of other considerations that she can look at. Like, has she been on antibiotics in the last 6 months? If she was, did she take probiotics to kind of reseed her gut bacteria and things like that? Are there changes in stress level? Are there changes in, there's just a whole bunch of different things that go into like making sure you have like the base kind of like, sort of healthy gut and that we're ready to roll. And then you introduce these things in a controlled environment and you can sort of like do some problem solving and figure out what works for you. Yeah.
I have a question on this, Kyle. I don't know if what's mechanically changing in our gut. I don't know if we know this, because the gut itself, it seems like it will be a perpetual mystery in terms of us like figuring out exactly how it works. But what's actually changing when I take in 60 grams an hour and my gut is upset to after I'm adapted and I'm taking in 120 grams an hour and my gut isn't upset? Is there anything that's actually that we know is changing in the gut?
So there's a couple things. One is that there's a couple things that are, I think, just if we start at the bottom and think about it, there's a couple really basic things about the gut that are really important. One is that it's one of the most rapidly turning over tissues in our body. It basically, the entire gut, the epithelial layer of the gut, basically, I don't know, someone's going to probably like get me on this, but it basically turns over like daily. So it's like not a small, it would shock you if you heard how much of your protein you just get from sloughed gut cells. Like the recycling slough gut cells, for example. Like, yeah.
That's
so
crazy.
So our the inside of the gut is constantly like dying and turning over and replenishing itself. So it'd be short-sighted to think that it's just this like static thing, even though I described it earlier as just this tube through your body. It's still like a really dynamic, living, complex physiologic system. So, and it's rapidly turning over, which means that it can be, it's adaptable. It can take on new characteristics. It can be those sorts of things. So there's probably like, from a mechanics, it's likely that there is increased receptor expression, but those types of changes, just like training adaptations, don't occur overnight. So it's not just like getting what's there used to being exposed to this new thing. There are actual, like, you're stimulating the system with a stress and a signal, and that signal, you have to have time to respond to that signal. And so there's going to be increased expression of the receptors in terms of the types of sugars that you're seeing. It's one of the arguments for giving it a variety of sugars, because you maybe will be stimulating a variety of responses in a way that makes you like on a greater scale, more able to take up sugars and things like that. And so there's those different types of things. The second thing is that the gut, so the gut's really interesting. It has, and again, I'm not an expert in the gut. I just know what I know from looking this stuff up and working with athletes. But the gut is the inside wall of the gut. It looks just like this, but these two hands, but the inside wall of the gut is actually a single layer of epithelial cells. So it's a muscle basically lined with a single layer of cells. And those single layers of cells are held together by what are called gap junctions. And when there's compromise, when those gap junctions get compromised, you can get like actual definition of endotoxins that creep in into the systemic system, or they get into niches that they're not supposed to be in because the integrity of that gut junction. And this is one of the things we know happens during really hot, like high intense exercise during the heat. One of the reasons why it messes with the gut is because it starts to compromise those gap junctions. So that's another like mechanical thing that may be just sort of like you're stressing the system in these new ways. You may be trying to like introduce some intensity or length, or you know, it's just, it's a very dynamic environment. So you have, it takes time to get the sort of gene and protein expression changes that can occur that are required to express the new proteins for adaptation. You have these mechanical or these, you know, different environmental and stress stimulus that could be compromising the gap junction. And there's probably some adaptations in creating greater integrity for there. And then the last part of it that I think is really important, is that the whole thing is covered in this slime. It's like this mucus layer that's really, really important. And the health of that mucus layer is critical to the integrity of the gap junction and the integrity and functionality of the gut in terms of absorbing nutrients. And so that mucus layer is also compromised with hard exercise, particularly the heat, in the heat. And so we put a lot of attention on taking care of the integrity of the gut, taking care of the integrity of the mucus layer, making sure that mucus layer is happy and interacting with gut bacteria and those types of things in a healthy way. And then we try and think about the different types of conditions, intensities, or products that cause GI distress. And we can't exactly identify and say, oh, that one's messing up your gap junctions, or that one's messing up. But we have to experiment at that point and try and figure out, okay, what's happening under these conditions? And what can we do to still maintain getting nutrients into the system, but like reduce the stress that's on your gut?
Okay. I have three questions kind of related to that. First one's not related. 17. Kyle, are you wearing two watches? First question.
Yeah. So they do different things. It's a carryover. I was on vacation at my mom's house in Georgia, and the new Apple Watch, for all that it like does, it has really bad tide functionality, and this one has really good tide functionality. And so we were like surfing and doing things. So anyways, the stopwatch is easier on this one. Yeah. There's real reasons for it, but yeah, I'm wearing two watches.
I don't know if you're familiar with DC Rainmaker, but he'll have like four watches on all the time.
I'm going to go look him up right now. No.
Okay. So the next question, putting these together, we talk about training the gut during exercise. What about if she ate more carbs while not exercising, just daily diet more carbs, and inside of that also eating more fruits and vegetables, things that are known to improve the gut bacteria in your stomach at the same time? Could those two things in combination then make it so that she can absorb more while she's training?
The first one I'm more dubious of for a variety of reasons. And I don't know this for a fact, but this is what my gut says, is that, no pun intended.
That's good. That's
great. It wasn't good. It was so bad. And it just came out too. That was not planned, I promise you. That was so bad. I give all these caveats because I don't want to be that guy. Look, this is like, you guys have a big platform and it's out of my, I don't want to be give the impression that I just like always know what's right under all Let's these speculate. Circumstances for everybody. Yeah.
Yeah.
So if I'm just giving you what I know at this moment, sitting in this chair, cause this is a really interesting question. I would say probably not because of the nature of specificity to stimulus adaptation. So if I think of it at just that basic level, it's like you don't get fitter by not exercising, for example. So it really is that unique milieu of the exercise plus the nutrient consumption coming
in. Load.
Exactly. And the thing is like, you know, there's a bunch of really interesting rabbit holes we could delve into about the nature of sustained high intensity exercise. Like what the evidence would suggest, and if you go look at like really interesting people like Daniel Lieberman, who's a anthropological, like basically performance physiologist at Harvard, which is a really cool job. He like studies performance physiology through the lens of the fossil record, essentially. And so he's the reason why people started running barefoot a couple of years ago. Anyways, because of that, we do seem to have no species on Earth can do slow endurance activity better than humans. But slow endurance activity, you can get away with using fat. When we're getting into these things like what we're talking about, where we want to be at high intensity, we're basically extending this skill that was sort of meant to close the deal on a hunt or evade. It wasn't necessarily meant to be like going up Alpe d'Huez hard as we can. Does that make sense? You can make that argument. So the idea that we could just eat carbs and then our gut starts to like carbs under any conditions is probably, but we are super adaptable. Like humans are adaptable. It's our number one quality. We're like way more adaptable than cockroaches. Like I'm not afraid of us, what's going to happen to us as a species because of our diversity and because of our adaptability. And so because of that, I think you have to recreate the specific circumstances if you want that stimulus. It's sort of like saying, well, I want to be a really fast sprinter, but I'm just going to run like long, slow. Yeah. And I'm going to hike the Appalachian Trail. You're not going to become a sprinter by hiking the Appalachian Trail.
So what about the fruit and vegetables, maybe eating lots of that to improve your gut health?
Yeah. So the vegetable part of it is, I think, more important than the fruit part of it. And this is probably going to, you know, incite a lot of, I think like fruits have a place. My sort of opinion in regards to fruits is to make sure that you're consuming fruits with a complex meal, because fruits are high in sugar. And depending on how your gut bacteria, how a person's gut bacteria is and how they respond to particular types of food, there is evidence that like certain fruits that are absolutely healthy for you they have lots of vitamins, micronutrients, and some, you know, five different types of fiber and things like that. But like a banana has a ton of sugar in it. And it, depending on how you absorb that, it can really cause a big insulin spike. And I think it's pertinent for most people living in modern society to try and manage the number of times that they get big insulin spikes per day. And so you're looking at, you know, three meals a day and maybe a post exercise recovery drink. And you know, a lot of times with carb modulation and stuff like that, you're actually looking more like three times a day. So 3 to 4 times a day, so if you do up your fruit intake, like I don't recommend that as like, you know, a lot of people say, oh, grab an apple. You'll hear dietitians and different people say this, grab an apple as a snack. It's like, I'd rather eat like beef jerky, to be honest with you, if you're hungry, because protein's more satiating, there's no insulin, there's no carbohydrates in it. If you're going to eat your apple, eat it, but eat it with your breakfast that also has protein and other complex, and you get it all on
like Captain Crunch.
Okay,
with Crunch Berries. I got you.
So tell me about the adaptation to that specific food to the roof of your mouth.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, pulling out for Nate's mouth. Poor thing.
Pretty strong. I'm just joking.
He had the orthodontist who put an iron plate in the top. I can't give him a cap and crown, so I'm going to install an iron plate in the roof of my mouth.
But in terms of like eating, maybe on the vegetable side of things, it's like things that are rich in fiber and that sort of thing.
Green leafy vegetables are amazing fiber source, and fiber is super important. This is a really interesting like topic, because there are times when you want things with fiber and there's times when you want things with less fiber, because we don't have the enzymes to break the glucose linkages that make up fiber. So they're beta, it is glucose. Like lettuce is glucose. Cell walls are glucose, right? Cellulose is glucose. They are polysaccharides, but we can't access the polysaccharides because of the way the glucoses are linked together. We don't have the enzyme that can link it, which is why we can't eat grass, but horses can or cows can. They get calories from grass because they have the enzyme that can break that linkage. So what is the role of fiber then? And the role of fiber, especially insoluble fiber. And what I say by insoluble fiber is like, if you take a bunch of grains that are high in soluble fiber and you say, oh, these are whole grains, there's lots of fiber in them. You put it in a bowl, you pour hot water on it, you come back a couple of minutes later, there's no more water and there's all these big swollen grains, right? That's soluble fiber. Part of that meal we can absorb. And when I say absorb, I mean get it through the gut into our system. And if we're thinking about it in terms of athletic performance, get it to the muscle so that it can be either stored as glycogen or used as glucose in glycolysis. And so if you, fiber doesn't do that. So how does fiber get broken down? Well, fiber gets broken down by the bacteria that live in our colon and our large intestine. And it serves other functions as well. It can add volume to stool. And particularly in the case of insoluble vitamin or insoluble vitamins, insoluble fiber, which is your lettuce, your green leafy vegetables, things like that. You put those in a bowl, you pour hot water on it, you come back 5 minutes later. It's just a bowl of hot floating lettuce, right? It's not taking on that water. And so those insoluble fibers are really important for greasing the tracks, so to speak, on your colon. And then also in softening the stool. And so it's really important for like regular bowel movements, regularity, those types of things to get all that fiber. And as Nate alluded to, these types of fibers are also fed on by the bacteria in our gut. That's how they get broken down. And it's critical to give them a variety of fibrous food sources, which is why a variety of raw vegetables is really important. And so the recommendation is, even if you are like nailing your macros, and we talked a lot about macros in the last episode and calculating them and things like that. One of the caveats with that is you can nail your macros, but at every meal, breakfast, lunch, or dinner, you should be getting some sort of raw uncooked vegetable. The reason why I say uncooked is because when you do cook it, there is some changes to some of the vitamins and minerals and the integrity and things like that. So having raw vegetables, uncooked vegetables is good and that's sort of a regular drip that you want coming into the system.
Yeah.
That is, this is total anecdote, but I've noticed, you know, I hit all my macros, but at times in training, we'll have like a bowl of spinach with salad with carrots and like some nuts and seeds and bell peppers and I don't know, some other vegetables that I would throw in there. And it wouldn't even be that much, but I do that every day. I would actually train. I'd feel so much better on the bike too. And I'm wondering if I was, like you said, feeding your gut the fiber that you need.
Go ahead.
My other part is I do protein shakes and I'll put spinach in there and blend the spinach. It's not enough, like it still stays cold, but is that going to mess something up or is that going to be just fine? Because I would normally just chew it, right? I would kind of be doing the same thing.
Yeah. So for your first question, that is, I don't want to say like, yeah, that makes total sense. That makes now.
You can't.
Because there's a bunch of things that could be happening there. Like it can kind of make sense for a variety of reasons, but we'd have to look at the complete picture. For example, like, if you're eating a bunch of spinach and now you're all of a sudden starting to feel better, I would wonder what your folate level was in your blood work iron, before you started eating the spinach. So iron's an interesting one because they do say spinach has a lot of iron, but that's for plants and it sucks compared to like
red meat,
basically eating blood. Yeah. So, yeah. And it's not in a very absorbable form. So anyways, you can't like combat anemia by just eating a lot of spinach. I wouldn't think. I don't like to make definitive statements, but that, no,
you're
that
scientist, you can't.
Yeah, exactly. So,
it seems to
it is possible. But if I said that, then would I be a true scientist? If I stated that it was impossible? Exactly.
No.
So the thing with this is that anecdotally, I do think it's really important to get raw vegetables at every meal, not every day, at every meal. And I don't think this has to be super complicated. And so I work with a lot of like people that are just straight out of college. They've turned pro. They're starting to like on their journey and they're like, how am I going to do this? And I was like, well, you buy one of those plastic tubs of spinach. And every time you start making a meal or you go by the fridge, you reach in, grab a handful and eat it. And like we've had success doing things like that, right? The other thing was I had one athlete one time that was recovering from injury and it was just like, you know, he couldn't train and this is his full-time job. He couldn't train and training was being boring. And we were just trying to talk about ways of like maximizing recovery or trying to support maximization and recovery and things like that. And one of the issues we had had was that his raw vegetable intake was just very consistent. It was the same sort of bowl of spinach with a few carrots and, you know, that sort of thing. It became too consistent. And I was like, all right, well, that's like as something to work on to give you something to do while you're recovering from this, a part of something to do while you're just cross training, doing rehab. Let's see how many different types of like cultivars of vegetables you can eat in a month. And I think he got 32 different raw vegetables in a month, right? It was just like every time he went to the store, he would buy like two things he'd never heard of. And then
just eat it raw
and just eat it, you know, and like, well, I mean, it's depends. Like, I wouldn't say like eat potatoes raw or something like that, but there's just different approaches like that to make sure that you're mixing and matching things. I've also gone all the way back to just like baby food packets for people that just can't get to eat raw vegetables, but there's no sugar added and there's no fruit in them. They're just the ones that are like, you know, peas and spinach, and it's just blended up and put in a baby food packet. And I can kind of get a certain type of person to eat that on a regular basis. And even that seems to be important. So the reason why the thing, it doesn't surprise me that you're feeling better, but we can't say exactly why, because there's just
right? also.
So many good things in vegetables. There's so many vitamins, there's so many minerals, there's so many micronutrients, so many phytochemicals, there's probably a bunch of things that this is one of the things that have, you guys might remember this, but a couple of years ago, there was a study that came out that basically showed that organic vegetables are no different than regularly grown vegetables in their like nutrition content. And I thought it was a really short-sighted study only in the sense that they were not very scientific, let's say. In saying, I thought it was a really bold thing to just say there's no difference in the nutritional value between these things when we probably don't know all the nutritious things. We can't just assume that, you know, vitamin A, vitamin B, vitamin C are the only things that matter when you're eating whole foods. And all the evidence would suggest that that isn't the case, that it's more than the sum of what we understand and know in terms of just strictly, because you can't, like, you probably wouldn't have felt that good if you had just taken vitamins in the exact same amounts as what we know of, right? But there's all these complex things going on with the micronutrients and phytochemicals and those types of things. The last part of it in regards to the gut bacteria is really interesting. There's lots of cool new studies coming out about the importance of gut bacteria in athletes and the importance of nurturing it and taking care of it and feeding it with the right. And, you know, a lot of times I think like a lot of things in the wellness and fitness industry, the sort of the growing thread of common knowledge around gut bacteria is creating all these products that are like underpowered, or they'll put a dash of something in that's 100 times below the effective thing, but then they'll market it as that thing and stuff like that. Yeah. So you have to like, so you should be considering those types of things. But when you take care of your gut bacteria and when you feed it these raw vegetables that are its preferred like food source, there's a bunch of different like theories of why that could be beneficial. There's impacts on the immune, on the immune systems, teaser, sort of for the, was that Laura's second question or a different question?
Oh no, it's the a different question. One.
Totally different question.
That's next month. Different day.
Yeah, exactly. So but there's also things like certain bacteria actually feed on lactic acid or lactate. I shouldn't say lactic acid. They feed on lactate, right? So, and then exercise also impacts the gut microbiota and the gut milieu. And then there's also, you know, one of the well-known kind of byproducts of probiotic bacteria or probiotic, metabolism is called butyrate, which is short chain fatty acid, which is really like anti-inflammatory and potentially immunomodulating, all these different things. And so the point is like, it doesn't surprise me that you feel better when you're eating lots of raw vegetables, and but it could be for like so many different interesting reasons.
I think the big point is everyone should just do it. The downside is it's even cheaper than like other food. You know what I mean? Like you go to the store, the vegetables are so cheap, at least in the US compared to like a package of Oreos or something like that.
I was having this discussion actually with a runner yesterday, and we were talking too about like, if you have to make tough cuts from a financial standpoint, and it sucks that people have to do this around their health and food and things like that. It just does. But like, there is an argument to be made to where like, if you're gonna spend a little bit more, or if you're gonna partition a little bit more, just this is my personal sort of thoughts on it, are to do it with your meat sources and your animal sources, because they're just harder to wash than vegetables and fruit. And there's, you know, everybody should go look at this. And there's this list that comes out from one of like a World Health Organization or something like that every year called the Dirty Dozen, which are sort of it's the 12 fruits and vegetables that require the most sort of pesticides and things to maintain their growth. And they also are the most delicate in terms of scrubbing and washing and trying to get those things. So blueberries are always on it. Strawberries are on it sometimes. There's different things like that. Whereas things like avocados, which have like amazing mixture of a variety of different fats, and they're high in vitamin E. They have good antioxidant capacity. They're just like a very nutritious food. They have this super thick, tough shell on the outside of it that you don't eat. So maybe save some money by not having organic avocados, for example. So you can be thoughtful about those types of things. It doesn't have to be just organic everything just because it's the most expensive thing and it's at Whole Foods.
This is a side note, but with, you know, AI is going to change the world. And I've seen, have you guys seen these huge things? They're almost like, they look like combine harvesters, but they're big machines and they go over the plants and they use lasers to not kill, to kill bugs, but also the weeds around it. And so they don't have to use pesticides and they just go, and it's like, just
interesting.
Yeah. It's like Star Wars, just killing all the bugs and everything. And then they don't have to, and they also have AI to pick the fruit too. So it's just at the right ripeness, right? Without having to use, rely on humans on their decision.
Our feeble human brain.
But you can imagine though how much the cost of organic food could go down if it was, you took out all the human labor power. And I know people are going to lose their jobs. Compost harvester, like cotton gin, all of these things over time. We used to have people do a whole bunch of work in tobacco and cotton and stuff. And, you know, people, evolution changed with inventions of science. And it is like, it's always a disruption to society. And AI is going to be huge. Like, maybe all of our jobs are going to be gone. But hopefully in the long run, it'll be better for humanity, and we will adapt, as Kyle says too.
Yeah, these things are super interesting. Wasn't there just a thing on the Daily Show about AI taking over? I think there was. There was just a skit. I'm sure it seems to be like this conversation, the conversation you have seems to be in the zeitgeist at the moment. Like, and I think it's really interesting because I do, I've used AI, for example, just for like fast to check recipes and things like that. Like the amount of feedback you can get, and the fact that we could now think, for example, that like Google is a clunky way to find information immediately. Like, that's crazy to me. Especially, I mean, like, I'm aging, or I'm aging myself. Is that what you said?
Yeah, yeah.
Anyways, I was raised when there was no internet. So like I have this perspective of like, I laughed at myself that it's like, oh, it's way easier to look up the protein content of this meal under using AI than it is using Google, which is ridiculous.
Yeah. Another side note, but John and I, our kids go to the same school, which is a Montessori school, and I love them so much, except for the tech side. And until recently, to look something up, they had to go to the library to look stuff up in a book. And I was like, my daughter's now in seventh grade. And now what they do is they're not allowed to use Google. They're supposed to go to only a few websites and use the search function on that website to look it up.
Right.
We're looking at something about Amazon dolphins, and my daughter's like, we have to do this. And I go, let's use ChatGPT. And I plugged it in ChatGPT. We got the list, and then we searched those websites through Google using the search function on Google, saying only search this website with Google. We cross-referenced. Everything was okay. And we wrote down the answers. But that's like, you got to teach the kids how to use AI, right? Like, if you can't use... Even with like at Trainer Road, engineers who don't understand how to use AI, because it can make 2-3 times your output, and everyone listening is like, if you're not able to use this stuff with your work, or you're trying to like go slow, you're going to be left out of the job market, because you're literally could be three times, like someone's output could be 3 times higher than yours. Why would they hire you? And even if you were the most amazing person, you could do it as fast as anyone humanly could, the person with AI is going to beat you. As the helper, who's still right now, it's a helper. When AGI comes, artificial general intelligence, where it's as smart as a human or can do a task that's better than a human, it's going to accelerate. You know, the progress will be 200,000 years in a year, because it's just going to be the amount of compute that can come up because it'll be able to self improve and stuff like that. And then we're going to have singularity, where it's going to be smarter than all humans put together.
Oh my God.
I'm bringing us back on track.
And then hopefully we have universal basic income, and we all just have fruits delivered to us in Terminator.
So, Kyle, I've got, and this is probably going to be the last question. We have 9 minutes left on the time here. I want to talk about limits. So like a person has exceeded, they've taken in too many carbohydrates that they can't process. Maybe it's this exact case that we're talking about here with this athlete, but any of us. So what is happening that causes the gut distress? We know the fact that we need to gradually build it up, but like what is happening actually mechanically that's causing that? And then if we have time for this, is there a limit? And like in should we basically be looking, because if you look at it in terms of if you look at it in terms of energy, I just want to put this in context, and I'm referencing this all the time on the podcast lately, but people, this is really important to remember. If you're riding at 89 watts for 1 hour, that means that you have burned 320 kilojoules. That's effectively equivalent to what you would take in if you are just taking in 80 grams an hour in carbs. Okay, so like that's why I'm getting at, to because energy debt is a massive reason that that performances are hampered when you're looking at athletes like, you know, whether it's Eliud Kipchoge or whether you're looking at somebody like Philippe Ogana that has an over 500 watt FTP. The poor man, like, like it's kind of a curse to have such a high FTP because he'll never be able to fuel adequately.
I have that curse.
Right. Everyone else would listen to this too. Sure. So I guess what's happening that causes the excess problem, and then we know that we can train it, so is there a limit to it?
So I'm more comfortable talking about the latter one than the first one. The first one, I just don't know. Like, I don't know exactly. I could pause it and you think that, like, and here's where osmolality could be an issue, the pH of the gut, the pH, like there's a bunch of different things where my mind goes. I've definitely worked more on the applied side when it comes to gut and getting food in while exercising than I have the mechanistic scientific side. So that part of it, I wouldn't feel comfortable answering. The second part of it, yes, there's a limit, but that limit is a completely floating target and it's going to be completely different. Now, there's going to be some exceptional individuals, because that's just how like talent and biology works. That's why like we have the diversity that we have, like not in a we're all special kumbaya kind of way, but they're literally like we're complex biological systems that are really unique from each other. And that's really beneficial for us as a species when you zoom way out on it. If I said this is the upper human limit, it would be like referencing Bolt's 9.58 in the 100 meter dash and saying, this is, no one's run fast, even with super spikes, whatever, like no one's run faster than a 9.58, but there's only one person to ever done it. So there probably is like some super upper limit that and I don't even want to posit what that is or put that out there. The highest I have experienced in just working with elite athletes is your guy or our guy, Keegan. He can eat more carbohydrates. And I think he's talked openly about this. I don't think this is anything.
Oh, yes.
It's not his secret. And I think he can continue to talk openly about it because I don't know if even if people tried or trained themselves, if they would be able to handle it. He's just like, it's literally a talent. And I think he's, I don't know. What's the last number he told you guys?
I think, well, this one, I kind of do actually want to be careful about saying one thing here, but he had like a plan. And I think the plan was like at least 120 grams an hour. But then when we did like a post, like we did like a post-mortem on it, turns out that it was like significantly higher than that. On our podcast, Mateo Jorgensen has mentioned taking in 160 grams an hour. I've seen that also from other very high-end athletes. Like when we're talking high-end athletes, really high-end triathletes have been experimenting with that I've seen.
Yeah, I've done 140.
This is like 160 to 180 I've seen people try. So
the if you go back and look at the papers on this from like a, you know, a decade or two ago, people are talking about how 40 to 60 is like the industry standard, which was mind-blowing. And with like special genetics and lots of training, some people might be able to get to 100. And when they started working on that Breaking 2 project, and they basically started applying. So this guy named Michael Joyner, who's a really, really smart PhD guy at the Mayo Clinic, he wrote basically a theoretical paper way before the Breaking 2 project. He wrote this theoretical paper basically saying, this is the blueprint for how a person could break the 2-hour marathon. And one of the principal components of that was consuming like this massive, this sort of unheard of amount of glucose to make up for just the lack of ability to store glycogen sufficient to complete this thing. Right. And so, now you're starting to hear these things that are just like 140, 160, more than 120. The plan was 120, but we blew it by it. Someone else has talked about, you know, that's sort of the highest that I've heard is that 140 to 160 range. And at some point, if we got to this point with hydration at one point where there were like these reports coming out that people were running marathons and gaining weight because of how much electrolytes and how much water they were drinking during the marathon. Cause they were so convinced that just more was better under all circumstances. And so there has to be, there's typically when it comes to performance, there's an upside down U where there's like sort of a range at the top and then it starts to actually diminish performance as the X keeps going out.
Yeah.
And so, whether it's throwing up, whether it's diarrhea, or it could just be like
pain.
It could just be physiologic. Like if you, so let's say all gastrointestinal issues aside, you could argue that like, why would I want to get to a point where I'm literally overeating? Like I'm eating beyond the ability of my muscles to process this much energy. So like under those circumstances, it would be like you'd have high blood sugar and you'd have muscle cells turning away blood sugar because they're saying we're at our max, even though we have, you know, so there's like a bunch of really interesting and dynamic like issues around that question because it, you know, we're thinking about it. I think it's a little myopic to only think about it in terms of what we can get through the gut into the system because the system will just burn everything that's in there. At some point, like these are just biological pathways that have limits. So it's based on the amount of oxygen you can get to the mitochondria, the amount of enzyme, you know, glycolytic enzymes you have, the amount of electron transport chain, the amount of mitochondria and the size of your mitochondria, the number of capillaries that you have, the amount of nitrate you have that's forming nitric oxide, that's increasing vasodilation to locally active muscles. Like there's so many it just gets the brain moving pretty quickly. So, but you know, around 140, 160 is the highest I've heard at this point. I don't think that that's right for everybody. And I don't think you have to strive to become the best version of yourself on the bike. I don't think you have to, I think it's really important. It's sort of like the conversation we had around weight, where it's a little bit dangerous to say what your number is and then, and then stake your success on this like thing that you may not have the biological capability of achieving. What I think is you have to say like, okay, I can understand why under certain circumstances this would benefit me. And as I continue to train and as those really long-term adaptations that occur in muscle efficiency and mitochondrial density and mitochondrial size and oxygenation and blood characteristics and capillarization, and as those things change, maybe I can take on more. And so maybe this is like a thing I'm thinking about over years, not in a small period of time. Like I'm starting at 20, but in 20 weeks for this like key effort of this year, I want to be at 120. That might not be realistic for all the reasons we've talked about, but that doesn't mean that 4 years down the line, you could be at 120, but you're probably also performing at a much higher level because you have all this long-term adaptations because of the continued consistency of your training and things like that. So yeah, in terms of, there probably is a physiologic peak. I don't know who the Usain Bolt is of carbohydrate. Like I said, the person I've worked with the most is Keegan, and we've like talked openly about that. But I think it's very cool because it's opening up, it's identifying these people that are talented in this way that also are combining talent with cycling. And when you're a match for those things, it's allowed the emergence of this new like prototype of a person that can just go so hard for so long because they're kind of sustaining themselves in just a way that people haven't experimented with. The last thing I'll say was something you touched on at the end of your question, which is there are physiologic limits to what we can do in terms of taking in sugar, but also in terms of producing power for certain amounts of time and things like that. And there will be like strategies and technology and unicorns and things like that that alter our perception of what the human body is capable of and stuff like that. But we can't just I can't just want it enough and go like run 50 miles an hour for 45 minutes with a pronghorn antelope just because like I want it, no matter how much I trained and things like that. So it's really important to understand like where your body falls in this, and you do want to push it, but if you don't respond to 100 grams of carbohydrates and you just keep pounding your head against that wall, it's going to start to negatively affect all these other things in your training and in your life. Some of them also mental, in just regards to like, what's wrong with me? I'm doing the thing they said to do on Trainer Road and it's not happening. And it's like, no, like, just pivot. You have to be adaptable. You have to pivot under those circumstances. Find a different way to get the most out of what you're working with at this moment, and then come and revisit that again way down the road, right? And that's how that level of consistency. But you can't be consistent if you pound into things so much that you end up overtrained, you end up sick, you end up taking these. The breaks are what like really prevent people from reaching their potential. The consistency is the thing we talk about all the time. B's and C's. Yeah. And then there's a 3-month period where workouts need to be A's and B's, but it's always about consistency.
So there's like this product called Red Light, Green Light, which will help with that, which you can find out at trinarode.com to make sure you're consistent and don't blow yourself up.
Well, so fantastic. I want to be very clear here. You're not paying me to do this. You're not paying me to say this. You're not paying me to.
That's true.
But I told Jonathan because I think you teased the red light, green light thing right after, and I told Jonathan, look, like this is being able to give actionable type feedback like that. There is a nutrition analog for it that works really, really well for people, of all ages in all different types of, conditions. And it's literally called the traffic light diet. And there are green foods that you can eat whenever you want, as much as you want, basically, vegetables, that are, low calorie vegetables. There are yellow foods that you eat, we need. So these are your macronutrients. So we need a certain amount of it, but too much of them in certain forms can be unhealthy. And then there's red foods like high fructose corn syrup and drinking a lot of calories and those sorts of things. In front of the label packaging experiments, where they just label foods in stores and cafeterias and things like that, have been very successful in influencing people's to make healthier food choices and drive people in a better direction in mass. So if you can get that recommendation, simple things can work. And so I'll just kind of put that in. Thanks, can God. I say one more thing too?
Yes, of course.
Nate, don't put spinach in your recovery drink.
Not recovery drink because of the fiber.
Because of the fiber.
Yeah,
that's right.
But just so daily though. I wake up. Okay. I want some extra protein.
Yeah,
with my
that's
meal.
Different. Yeah, that's different.
Cool.
Yep.
And you don't want to put that spinach in the recovery drink because you don't want to slow the digestion, those
absorption,
good
yeah.
nutrients getting exactly. into you very quickly.
Exactly. That recovery drink, food, right? The recovery drink is special for hard training athletes. It's not, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. It's not for just recreationally active that's, you know, eating healthy and eats lunch within an hour of finishing their workout. And they did, you know, a half an hour, 45 minutes on the elliptical machine. That's you're not pounding recovery drinks, but for really hard training athletes, a recovery drink is super important. And the absorptability of that is really critical. And the faster we can get that, particularly sugar, into the system, the faster your blood sugar can rise and the bigger insulin response you can get, which again is anathema to like public health recommendations. But when you get a nice insulin response, insulin is a very powerful anabolic hormone. So that's a good recap.
Awesome. What an awesome podcast. Thanks a bunch, Kyle. Appreciate it. If anybody wants to follow Kyle or anything else, we'll link down below. He isn't very active on Instagram because he's busy doing scientist things. So, but you can follow him on there. Anyway, follow Trainer Road.
Yeah.
Put down in the comments, if you're watching this below, I should have said this in the beginning, but put down in the comments down below how many carbs you take in. Maybe I'll see if I can put a poll down there. And it'd be fun to just like source and see how many carbs per hour people take in right now, and then maybe we'll do a proxy with this, and you know, later on we'll test it again. But it'd be very interesting. Thanks, everybody.
Hey, real quick, shout out to our guy Josh Kerr, who he in the last episode we talked about him breaking the world indoor 2-mile record, and then a couple of weeks later he went to his hometown his home country in Scotland, and won the world indoor 3,000 meter championship. So nice. champ now. So it's pretty good. So big shout out to those guys. And it's exciting to see the cyclists getting ready to go as well. Like races are getting close. So it's cool.
It's going to be a good season for Kyle's athletes. That's for sure. All right, everybody. We'll talk to you later. Thanks.
All right. All good. Thanks.